Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor of the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese. In our bi-monthly interviews, we converse with philosophers about the ideas expressed in their newly published books. Today's interview is with Miguel de Baeztegui, professor of philosophy at the University of Warwick. His latest book is Aesthetics After Metaphysics, From Mimesis to Metaphor, just out from Routledge. What is the nature of art? The question involves understanding the relation between art and reality and what we're expressing when we use an artistic means of communication rather than ordinary language or everyday craft. De Baeztegui provides a framework for understanding art that stands in contrast to a metaphysics that posits a sensible world of experience and a supersensible world of forms or essences, one in which art, even non-representational and conceptual art, in some cases, exists as a mimetic go-between. De Baeztegui suggests instead that art captures an aspect of reality that is literally there, an excess of the sensible that is typically hidden by our everyday practical ways of interacting with and experiencing reality. Our grasp of these features is metaphorical in that they're shared by things that are usually put in distinct categories, but it is an impoverished notion of metaphor that prompts us to think that what is metaphorical is not literally true. In this richly suggestive and provocative volume, De Baeztegui draws on thinkers from Plato and Nietzsche to Merleau-Ponty and Danto, and discusses works by a wide range of artists, including Proust, de Kooning, and Chiyoda, to illustrate his view. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Miguel de Baeztegui.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you.
I'm really excited to be talking with you about your new book, Aesthetics After Metaphysics, From Mimesis to Metaphor. It's a short book, but it's just packed with a lot of provocative and very interesting philosophical ideas, and it covers a great deal of territory, from Heidegger and Deleuze, who are part of your background more than mine in particular, but also a number of interesting artists that I'm not aware of, Chiyoda, for example, Chiyoda, but as well more familiar figures such as de Kooning or Proust. Before we get into the details of the book, I just wanted to have you say something a little bit about your background on the interest of this topic of art and the nature of art and the genesis of this particular book.
Right, yes. Well, the book that you mentioned actually began with a systematic study of Proust. And it's an extension of that other book that was also just translated, which I wrote in French initially. And in French, it had the title, if I translated in English, The Joy of Proust. But it's translated as Proust as Philosopher, and it has the subtitle Towards an Aesthetics of Metaphor. And it's really when trying to accommodate what I found Proust saying and doing with metaphor in a larger philosophical framework that I started writing Aesthetics After Metaphysics. And so it began with a systematic study of Proust, with what Proust has to say about metaphor in his great novel, but also and above all with his own metaphors. And what I found out is that what he has to say and what he does with metaphor resists the traditional framework in which metaphor has classically been thought. And that's a framework that's essentially Aristotelian. And I try to show in the book on Proust, and then I go over this again, but very briefly in Aesthetics After Metaphysics, that the classical conception of metaphor that runs through very much the history, not just of philosophy, but poetics and rhetoric, is essentially Aristotelian.
Mm-hmm.
And what Proust says and does with language, with metaphor, that he very interestingly characterizes the essence of style. So for him, metaphor is style. Well, simply doesn't fit with that classical understanding of metaphor. And Aristotle, in the Poetics, defines it as, in the following terms. He says metaphor consists in giving the thing a name that belongs to something else. And he says the transference being either from genus to species, or from species to genus, or from species to species, or on grounds of analogy. And later on, metaphor will be restricted to the movement from a literal meaning to a figurative one, and most often by way of analogy. Now, what's interesting is that Proust's own definition is actually quite different. And what Proust says is that, well, by metaphor, we should understand something very different. We should understand the ability, he says, to see the beauty of something in something else. Right? And what that means is that for him, there isn't anything intrinsically beautiful about any specific object, but it's the ability to make a connection between two objects that are most often separated in space and time that brings them together in a way that is unusual, and yet that we're able to recognize as true, that characterizes metaphor. And what I try to do then in Aesthetics After Metaphysics is to provide a philosophical and specifically ontological framework in which to think metaphor, understood in that way.
Yeah. So the idea of truth, and what sort of truth art is pointing at or expressing seems to be the core of the book as I understood its argument. To work into that that idea of truth, you begin by raising what you call the question of art, and I take that to be a question of what it is and how art relates to what else there is in the world or in reality, as we will ordinarily say. Could you maybe explain first this core question, the question of art as you understand it?
Well, the question of art as a whole, I'm not entirely sure about. What I really started with is a certain experience of art through metaphor. So it was really rooted in language and in literature in particular. But then I think it extended into something much broader. And what I was really taken by is the extent to which the experience and domain that I think metaphor opens up just doesn't fit with the way in which philosophy has classically understood art. And philosophy has classically understood art in connection with a certain conception of truth,
yeah.
A conception of truth that is essentially of an intelligible order, right, of a conceptual order. And so the value of art and the place of art was considered only to the extent that it could be seen as a stage, as it were, on the way to truth understood in that way, right? So this is why I say that art is essentially, or rather the philosophy of art is essentially Platonic or Platonistic, if you will, because it is seen as a kind of mediation between the world of the sensible world, and the supersensible world, the intelligible world, the world of ideas and concepts. And it's only insofar as it allows one to make that bridge between the sensible and the intelligible that it gains its value. And I try to show how that metaphysical conception of art and the value of art doesn't do justice to what we actually experience in most artworks. And of course, there is a whole tradition of art that falls within what I call the mimetic paradigm. But there's also another tradition, and sometimes even the same works themselves, that can be seen in a very different light. So it's that domain of experience that I wanted to retain and connect with the concept of truth, but of course a different concept of truth.
So this notion of mimesis, when you in the book, when you began by saying that in some senses art is still fundamentally mimetic, you know, my first response to that was, well, how could that possibly be, you know, after Kandinsky or Warhol or even conceptual art. And as I read along, I sort of realized, well, first of all, you give a very nice analysis of the different ways in which mimesis has been understood from Plato and Aristotle. So maybe you could explain the view that you are responding to a little bit in more depth, the mimetic metaphysics that you think is, as you just mentioned, is just not adequate to the phenomenon.
Yes. Now, to be perfectly clear, I don't say and will never say that art is fundamentally mimetic, right? But what I do say is that mimesis is the fundamental concept with which, up until Nietzsche, really, philosophy thinks art. And right. I, through much of the history of philosophy, trying to show that that's the case. Now, this is very different because I think that philosophy was for a long time lagging behind art and not understanding what it was actually doing, right? So it was approaching art and the experience of art from a very specific metaphysical standpoint and was trying to integrate it within a metaphysical framework, which I think much of art escaped from the start, as it were. Now, that being said, I also try and show how some abstract art is still mimetic and still Platonistic. And I'm thinking here precisely of Kandinsky, whom you mentioned, mm-hmm. but also of someone like Mondrian. Because there's a whole tradition in art, going back to the late Renaissance, I think, that thinks of mimesis as imitation not of actual things as we see them in the world, but as imitation of pure forms and ideas.
Right.
And so for me, the distinction between imitative and non-imitative art doesn't coincide absolutely or doesn't coincide necessarily with the distinction between figurative art and abstract art.
Okay, that's good.
But for me, there's a form of abstract art that remains completely mimetic or Platonistic. And in the same way, and this is what I try to show by with some sort of Renaissance painters, but also with de Kooning, who's somewhere in between, that there's some painters who are seemingly figurative and yet not mimetic. So the dividing line for me is not between figuration and abstraction.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the key distinction. I don't know if I sort of answered your question.
Well, maybe you could say what in Kandinsky is mimetic?
Well, so who knows whether there's any justification in what I saw in Kandinsky, but it seems to me that his whole quest is a very spiritual and even religious one, and is one that aims to arrive at certain pure forms that are indeed a form of negation of the sensible. So that art, even though art remains, of course, as steeped in materiality and sensibility, what it is pointing to is something that transcends that. And that, for me, remains a very sort of Platonistic.
I see. So you, now, on your view, you, you're aiming at a metaphysics in which you have the hypersensible, which is somehow between the sensible and the insensible, if you want to maintain that distinction to begin with. And so there's a couple of very key concepts that you introduce. One is this idea of the realm of the hypersensible, and that there's a special sense of vision, not you know, ordinary sense perception, but some sort of artistic vision that is specific to how we access that realm of the hypersensible, and that art, as a result, is metaphorical rather than mimetic, and that. And this introduces the concept a concept of metaphor in which it's presenting a truth, a literal truth, but not the usual sensible literal truth that we're thinking about when we're not talking about art. Those three concepts of, you know, the hypersensible, the sort of vision that we have, and then the sense of metaphor, of course, that's the key that sort of brings everything together. Maybe you could say something about, you know, what the hypersensible is, as you put it, an excess of the sensible.
Right.
And then we'll go through the others as well.
Yes. Now, to be perfectly honest, I mean, I had doubts about this very notion of the hypersensible, because as far as I know, it's not one that you can find anywhere else. So the idea of creating kind of notion to characterize or to designate a domain of experience and reality is always problematic. But what I meant by that is that indeed the domain of experience and reality in which metaphor, as I understand it, is rooted, and therefore at least a certain kind of art is rooted, simply escapes that distinction that philosophy has always operated with, or for a very long time, which is the distinction between the sensible and the supersensible or the intelligible. So in that respect, the hypersensible is not somewhere in between the two, but it's altogether outside. It sort of bypasses and cuts across that distinction. So that's why I spend quite a bit of time in the first part of the book trying to deconstruct that metaphysical paradigm to show how it's been operative and to show its force, but then to really distinguish it from what I call the hypersensible, which simply cannot be accommodated within the classical distinction between the sensible and the hypersensible. So what do I mean by this excess of the sensible itself? Well, it's precisely a certain experience of the sensible, a certain relation to the sensible world that is opened up in art and in art only, and that doesn't point beyond itself towards something like the intelligible world, the world of pure concepts, the world of forms, the world of philosophical truth. Mm-hmm. And yet I think there is an experience of truth in that, but one that is very different from the Platonic one, if you will. Now, it means that we need to redefine in a way what we mean by sensation, by matter, by vision, which you mentioned, and which maybe I could move on to explain a bit further. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's fine.
Now, the way in which I introduce artistic vision is by contrasting it with ordinary perception. And I think another classical sort of connection that's been made, which for me is problematic, is the one precisely between perception and artistic vision, as if the vision of the artist, the way in which the artist brings something into the work of art, which we perceive, were simply on a plane or on a level that was consistent with ordinary perception. And there I really believe that our ordinary perception of the world is one that is overdetermined by practical as well as theoretical concerns, so that our orientation in the world is one that is pre-directed, if you will, pre-formatted by the way in which we want to act in the world, act on the world, and the way in which theory also comes into line with this hands-on approach to the world. And artistic vision, so this is what I call sort of monoscopic perception, if you will, right? We zero in on the world, and that is the way in which we perceive the world. Whereas it seems to me that artistic vision, and specifically metaphorical vision, requires a stereoscopic vision, one that forces the eye to look at two different places, two different times at the same time, and therefore to arrive at an experience of the world that is indeed extraordinary, right? That is not rooted in perception in the way that I think it normally operates. So I think artistic vision in that respect opens up the world in a way that is different from the way in which we normally see the world. But it opens up the world in a way that is nonetheless not subjective or arbitrary. And that is why I think we can recognize a certain truth within artworks and metaphors in particular. There's a strange encounter. I think we recognize something as being there, and yet we say, oh, I had never seen it in that way. So it's that sort of double recognition that I find interesting. Because when we find, if we again think of metaphor as exemplifying this relation, in metaphor, when we read a good metaphor, we don't think of it, oh, this is just, you know, Coleridge or whoever drawing up a nice metaphor. But we see the world in the way that he sees it, and we recognize it as part of the world itself. And therefore, it's not purely something that's on the side of the subject, right? But something is being said about reality itself.
So one of the interesting things that you said about this different sort of looking at the world, you contrasted it with phenomenological aesthetics and Merleau-Ponty, and that whole tradition of phenomenology, which is very rooted in the practical and, you know, seeing things as tools and, you know, seeing things in terms of the way we use them in practical life. And you contrast that with this new sort of vision. Right. How is it that we do this? I mean, obviously we don't, it can't just be a stepping back the way phenomenologists, you know, want us to step back. How is it that we attain this other sort of access to reality?
Right. Now, can I just say, in connection with phenomenology, that people would need to distinguish, as it were, between various strands of phenomenology. And I try to do that in the book. And the most interesting character for me in that respect is Merleau-Ponty, who begins his work with the phenomenology of perception, as you know, but who later on in his work moves away from the primacy of perception to an extent, I think, and towards what he calls the visible and vision. And then he becomes much closer to what I call vision. What I call the hypersensible through his discussion of what he calls the flesh and his notion of the vision and the visible, which he recognizes aren't reducible to the Platonic sensible or to the world as an object of pure perception. Now, to answer the second part of your question regarding how this is done or how this comes about, well, I think we have to recognize the fact that it is a form of construction. That is to say, that kind of vision, I think, does not exist outside of the artistic procedure. So that it's not as if, and this is why I think it's a radical break with mimesis, because it's not as if we could, having seen it in the work of art, we could see it, as it were, in reality outside the work of art. So we see something with the work of art that we recognize as real or true, and yet it's not something that we could have ever seen without the work of art. Do you see what I mean? So I think it has a distinct relation to reality and requires this stepping back from a practical, ordinary perception into a form of vision that requires a transformation. So I think one could still account for it in phenomenological terms by looking at the specific form of vision that art requires, but one that indeed requires a modification or a transformation of ordinary perception. Why? Because ordinary perception, again, I think, is in space and time and directed towards a specific kind of object. Whereas artistic vision, insofar as it is metaphorical, requires a loosening, if you will, of that focus in space and time, and requires the ability to bring together object, dimensions, aspects of reality that are normally separated for practical reasons, so that we have connections that are made that are extraordinary, and yet that we recognize as being part of the fabric of reality. I don't know if I'm making my...
Yes, very, very much. I wanted to press you on this notion of metaphor that is so central to the book, and which you've just been clarifying for me even more. So if you could just explain a little bit what you mean about this metaphorical, the metaphorical use of art. Yeah.
Now, again, I think that the reason why, and I've encountered this on many occasions, the reason why it is, I think, difficult to understand metaphor in that way is because metaphor has, again, been defined in ways that have gone entirely unchallenged, if you will, by Aristotle. So if you go back to Aristotle's Poetics and then go through the history of poetics and rhetoric, you see that it's this, with some variation, it's the same definition that's repeated time and time again. But what I think is that Aristotle has a relatively poor understanding of metaphor, and not only a poor understanding of metaphor, but a very metaphysical one. Right? I think it is rooted in his own philosophy and his own ontology in particular. And I think that if we really look at how metaphors work, then we realize that there's more to them than that movement that came to be identified as the movement of metaphor from the literal to the figurative. And that, I believe, is the difference between metaphor and allegory. And I try and identify the differences between metaphor, allegory, and symbol. And my first experience of this, again, was reading Proust and what he has to say about metaphors, as well as his own practice of metaphors. But I also found confirmation of what I thought in other writers and works of art. And I do sort of close reading of certain poems by Hölderlin. But I also found confirmation of what I thought against, on the philosophical side, against harsh critics of metaphor, Derrida, Heidegger, and Deleuze, whom you mentioned earlier on. For example, in Danto's work and his notion of expression in the transfiguration of the commonplace, connection that he makes with metaphor. So I find myself quite close to not so much what Dante says about metaphor, but about more about what he says about expression and transfiguration. And in that book, he says metaphor supposes a work of transfiguration, or as I call it, a work of transposition. And he, on that question, I think he is really quite interesting. I mean, he takes the example of Liechtenstein's portrait of Madame Cézanne, in which he says the subject is transfigured and transposed as a diagram. Now, it's that operation of transposition that I think is distinctively metaphorical. But he, and I think he's absolutely right, insists that that operation of transposition is not from the literal to the figurative. It's not from the sensible to the intelligible. It's not allegorical in that way. It retains a connection with the sensible and remains within the sensible itself. And he writes, to see that portrait as a diagram is to see that artist as seeing the world as a schematized structure. Right? And I introduce the notion of metaphor as the schema of the hypersensible, but the schema understood in the Kantian sense. But whereas schema here is not the presentation of a concept, right? But is the presentation of the sensible itself. And earlier on in his description of the painting, Danto sort of remarks on the Nouet on the extraordinary and even monstrous work involved in such a transfiguration, which presupposes, he says, a certain dehumanizing of the subject. And he goes on to say, as if the person were so many planes treated with no more and no less intensity and analytical subversion than a wax apple. And he does characterize this operation as metaphorical transfiguration. And he takes the other example, and I'll stop here, but of Gainsborough's painting of St. James's Mall, and he writes that it is a picture of Regency ladies promenading, but the women, he says, are also transfigured into flowers, and the alley into a stream they float along. And that, I think, is very close to what Proust says about Elstir the painter in his novel. It's almost the same vocabulary in the way that he depicts the relation between the seashore and the sea, between land and sea. And there are other instances of that kind in Proust's novel where, for example, Albertine is shown to not to resemble, if you will, a flower, but to have sort of flower qualities that he extracts. And we as a reader end up realizing, yes, Albertine is not just a woman, but at a certain time of day when she's asleep in a certain kind of position, she has that flower in her, as it were. And that, I think, is a specifically sort of artistic operation that we recognize with art throughout, with the help of art. And even if we recognize it ourselves outside of art, I think it's already an artistic operation because it has required this transformation of the way in which we look at the world.
Well, a couple of questions have come to mind, but one was this this idea that if it is a transfiguration of the commonplace or the, you know, anything, then in a sense, the hypersensible is really all around us, and it's not just not just artworks, or is that incorrect?
No, I think it is all around us, but yet I think that here I'm speaking sort of as a phenomenologist, right? But our engagement with the world, the way in which normally we relate to the world, is one that requires that we bracket the hypersensible. Do you see what I mean? Because
yes.
if I'm correct that there is a connection between perception and action, then the hypersensible is that domain of experience to which we are open, but that suspends the possibility of action. Do you see what I mean? It is
yeah.
Not-
use the common example in phenomenology of the hammer, right? We look at the hammer and we see, you know, it as a particular something that does particular work for us, and that's inevitably or not the way we see it. We see it as a tool, as something that will hammer in nails. And from what I gather, and correct me if I'm wrong, we can also look at a hammer in this with this artistic vision.
Yes.
And see qualities of it that have nothing to do with or that bracket exactly the sorts of practical considerations in which we normally view the hammer.
Yes.
And bracket those.
Yes.
And see it as with the hypersensible properties that it has. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, that is spot on, because from a philosophical perspective, normally the alternative to the practical is the theoretical. So you have the Platonic view that says, okay, then we will ask about the idea of the hammer. You know, we relate to the hammer no longer as a tool, but as an essence or as an idea. We can relate to the hammer as the idea of the hammer. But what you suggested absolutely rightly is that this hammer can also be seen in a way that is reducible neither to the practical nor to the theoretical, but to what I call the artistic, and that requires a reconfiguration of the world as hypersensible.
And would this occur?
But at the same time, I think there's a moment of creation in that, right?
Right.
So there's a seeing that's also a creating. It is one that cannot be simply derived from sort of analyzing or taking the hammer down to its sort of small bits and pieces and understanding it as as a hammer thing.
So maybe you could. I was going to ask: is this a sort of operation that requires a particular context? Like, I'm thinking of somebody like Duchamp, who takes an ordinary tool, in his case, a urinal, and puts it in a context, and there we are able to see it in this, presumably, in its metaphorical glory. But of course, he was, an artist, and he had this context in which that was done. Mm-hmm. And normally, of course, that would not occur, or can it occur in everyday life?
Well, I think if it occurs in everyday life, it's no longer everyday. I mean, I think there are moments of suspension of the everyday in everyday, and I think artists explore those moments, those tears that were in the fabric of the everyday, which is, I think, taking your example of the hammer again, is mostly determined by a practical relation to the world. But there are moments in which this ordinary practical relation to the world can be suspended, and I think the artist is possibly distinguished by his or her willingness to remain with that moment and explore that particular moment, which requires a dissociation from the ordinary perception of the world and requires a certain training and a certain reinvention of what it means to see that particular object. So I think what happens with Duchamp is indeed through this displacement of the object, which is partly metaphorical, putting a big question mark on that ordinary object and inviting us to see it. I think in his instance, it's very much an invitation. So it's part of the metaphorical work that is done. But I think he is locating the effort and the work on the side of the viewer. And he's saying, now you do the work. This is the most ordinary and in a way vulgar and base object. And you have to turn it into something interesting. And of course, I'm very interested in that particular gesture. But I don't think that it would qualify as metaphorical all the way, as it were. Right? But it's certainly a step, in a way, the first necessary step in order for that tear and that suspension of the everyday to take place.
How do you fit conceptual art into this? Were you not looking at a particular? Well, you may or may not be.
You can imagine that having sort of set up a certain domain of artistic experience in the way that I have, I also have problems with a certain conceptual art. Because everything that I try and do is to show the extent to which art forces us to remain within the sensible, but a sensible that is in excess of itself and opens up an altogether different domain of sensible experience. And if conceptual art is indeed the immediate connection between an object and a concept, then I think of it as it's going to sound paradoxical because, of course, I'm a philosopher, but I think of it as too philosophical in the Platonic sense of the term, as an invitation to translate a particular sensible object into something that is conceptual. So in a way, I think that concepts are, how can I say, that concepts are the enemy of art.
Well, so is conceptual art in an interesting sense still mired in mimesis?
Well, I think so. I think that now we'd have to go sort of case by case, because of course those labels, you know, are only labels, and then I'm sure that, you know, given a conceptual artist, we could see his or his work or a particular work from a completely different point of view. But I would say, in a very sort of schematic and possibly reductive way, that yes, that enterprise, that specific program, is not one that I want to follow particularly, because it does away with what I think is the specific value of the artwork, especially from a philosophical point of view. You see what I mean? It resists the operation of the concept and yet forces the philosopher to rethink his or her own concepts in light of that experience. So if conceptual art is perhaps too driven by philosophy in a way.
Yeah. So I've, one question I have was, are there artists, you know, sort of pre, I don't know, you know, I don't know how far back to go, that would be exemplars of your view of art as metaphor rather than mimesis?
So you mean going back?
Yeah, art historically.
Going back in history. Well, in connection with Tieda, I mention certain artists that he mentioned, and Grünewald in particular, and try and show how within a completely figurative painting there are moments that I think open up that dimension of the hypersensible. Mm-hmm. So what I would want to say is that even within a particular, let's say, a particular painting, there can be an aspect, a moment of that painting that escapes its own mimetic macro structure, if you will. And I give the example of a certain ways where the point of departure is the question of the fold in Chida's work, and the way in which he points to certain Renaissance painters as having, and of course one thinks of the late Renaissance in particular, as having sort of developed this technique of the fold in fabric, in clothing, or in, for example, in the hair of a particular figure that is painted in such a way that there is something absolutely fluid, liquid, if you will, that enters the painting. Or there is something, yeah, absolutely floating that is suggested through the almost infinite repetition of folds. So you have a sort of marine element that is introduced in the painting, although of course water is nowhere indicated or signified, if you will. Do you see what I mean? So there is an ability to use something that is the materiality of which clearly belongs in something that we recognize as clothing or hair, and yet there is, through the way in which they are depicted, an absolute fluidification, and therefore a marine element that is introduced in the painting, and that to an extent becomes overwhelming. And that, I think, is a metaphorical operation where something is used to make a connection with something that it clearly is not. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, how about, I mean, I was actually thinking of the cave paintings, you know, you know, that far. Yeah. Chauvet or Lascaux.
Right.
Those seem to be the sorts of works that would fit very nicely, I think, into your view.
Yes, well, thank you. I had not gone that far back. No, but that's, I mean, every time I have a discussion
with some of they come up with, you know, examples that, I mean, the other day I was having a discussion about the lack of the presence of music in the book.
Yes.
And where music would figure. And there's a part of me that's quite reluctant to talking about music because I'm simply not a musician at all and not trained at all in music and feel like a bit of an imposture talking about music. But all along, I did have music as a possible paradigm for metaphor itself. Now, there is a certain, of course, music that is itself mimetic, and we know very well that certain melodies are supposed to evoke, you know, certain experiences or even certain aspects of nature, I think. But there's also more, perhaps in more contemporary music, a relation to music that is completely outside anything that is recognizable and yet opens up that domain of the hypersensible. So in a sense, I could understand music as being the very paradigm of the metaphorical operation that I see as intimately bound up with this other dimension of the sensible that I call the hypersensible.
So to return to the idea of the relation between metaphor and truth, right? You know, standardly, of course, we distinguish, you know, literal truth versus figurative truth, and you're saying there's another
exactly.
As I understand it, it's another kind of literal truth. Would that be correct?
Yes. If by literal we mean
reality.
Yeah, exactly. But it requires a real modification of our relation to the world. So it's another domain of experience. It's not one that is continuous with the previous one. So yes, it would be a third domain of truth. And I use the word. I don't hesitate to use that word because they are worthy predecessors, I think, who have used it without feeling that they were, as it were, betraying the very notion of truth. And again, I was mentioning Dante. He has no problems using that word in connection with art and with the Transfiguration. And but of course, you know, Heidegger would be another example. And the first perhaps would be Nietzsche, right? For whom art, on one level, is a way of preserving us from truth, but the truth that he has in mind is Platonic truth, and yet opening up this other truth, which is the truth of what he calls the earth, which is precisely outside the distinction and opposition between the sensible and the supersensible.
Could you expand a little bit on Nietzsche's role in providing a basis for this non-mimetic?
Yeah. I mean, I do think that this mimetic paradigm really, you know, begins to shift and be called radically into question with Nietzsche. And the relation between art and truth is, in the process, also entirely reconfigured. And I wouldn't say simply abolished, right? So truth, as I was saying, truth is no longer identified with the supersensible, with the intelligible, no matter how we want to define the intelligible, because I think the way that Kant defines it is different from the way that Plato defines it, and yet what matters, I think, is the emphasis on the intelligible. So truth is no longer identified with the supersensible, with the unchanging or the eternal, but with the sensible, with becoming, with contingency and chance. And this is what he calls the reversal of Platonism. But insofar as the very idea of the sensible world made sense only within its opposition to the intelligible world or the true world, the sensible itself needs to be, Nietzsche claims, entirely reconceived. It needs to be reinvented. It needs to be revalued. So the sensible that we're left with is no longer the sensible that has always been subordinated to the intelligible. And this is where art comes into play. Now, we have art so that we don't perish from the truth, Nietzsche writes. Art is the force that allows us to create new values and remain, as he says, true to the earth. But this notion of truth to the earth is, of course, very different from the truth that that he identifies with Platonism, that is to say, with the the intelligible world. So I do think that Nietzsche opens up another domain for thinking the connection between art and truth.
So to pursue this, the connection between metaphor and truth, it would be good to understand a little bit better the truth that is got at through art or through this artistic vision. It's not essence. I take it, and at least not essence in an Aristotelian sense.
Yes.
And yet, that's the sort of view that that is suggested, for example. And I'm not saying that you suggest it, but when you in the example of the woman, a woman who has flower properties.
Mm-hmm,
right,
mm-hmm.
In a particular situation,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We are not. I mean, a more traditional view would be we are getting at some sort of maybe we might say it's a truth about her. We probably say it's a figurative truth, but it because she isn't literally a flower.
Right.
And then somebody might say, well, you know, we're getting at something essential about her, which she, you know, which we designate with a flower type concept.
Yes.
And you don't want to say that by doing that we are getting at an essence of some sort. So how would you distinguish what we're getting at when we describe somebody that way, or you know, have a work that is, you know, expressing the hypersensible? How would you distinguish that from the more, you know, ordinary way in which we would describe what it is that we are accessing?
Right. Now, I wouldn't have a problem with characterizing it as essence if we didn't have a conception of essence that is fixed, unchanging. Precisely, essence normally has designated what is eternal, what is unchanging, what is of the order of being and not becoming, etc. Right? It's always been located on that side. But if by essence we meant something that is more on the side of becoming, on the side of a certain unfolding, on the side of a certain aspect that under certain conditions cannot be seen, but under certain other conditions can emerge and come to the surface, then I wouldn't have a problem calling it essence. But I just don't want to confuse things by calling, you know, essence something that is the opposite of what's normally called essence. So indeed, the question is, you know, how would we call that? And I think that there is, in the case of Albertine Sleep, well, the example that you mentioned, there is how can I say, not an essence Albertine, but an event Albertine, that under certain conditions at a particular moment, Albertine is able to reveal herself in a way that when she's awake, when she's interacting with Marcel in a way that is determined by, of course, that practical life together, but also by his obsession with her possible infidelity, etc. She cannot be seen in that way. And it's only, yes, when she's asleep, when he can look at her from a certain distance, that then certain singular points in her, which are covered over by the ordinary points that configure her, if you will, normally, can finally emerge. So one could say it's a flower, but under a different set of circumstances, it could be something very different. It could be an animal. It could be a thing. Do you see what I mean? So it would be difficult to call it an essence, because it would only be under certain circumstances that these virtualities, and I call them virtualities, can come to the surface. So there is, if you will, the actual Albertine, or there is the actual woman, for example, in, and I make the connection between the two, that de Kooning may have painted in his series of sort of woman in the 1950s. And then there is the virtual woman. And the virtual woman is one that has all those possible connections with entirely unexpected other points, other things in the world, and that the artist brings together in a way that we recognize as real, that we recognize as being there, if you will. And that's for me, that's very important, that we don't see it simply as, oh, this is only Marcel, or whether Marcel the narrator or Marcel Proust, or this is only de Kooning.
Mm-hmm.
See, isn't it extraordinary that in a woman there is also a sea, in the case of de Kooning, or also a flower?
In a sense, our language fails us, I think.
Very much so, very much so. And our language is, at least when it comes to trying inscribing this in a theoretical framework, is metaphysically overdetermined. So we are indeed struggling with a metaphysical inheritance that is difficult to do away with, and we don't want to start speaking also a language that no one understands.
Exactly. I was just going to mention, we don't also want to start inventing terms and then get everybody confused.
Exactly. So hence my reluctance even with the word hypersensible, and if anyone could come up with a better word, you know, I'd be delighted if I were to, you know.
Yeah. So I think we're starting to come to the end, running out of time here. But I did want to ask a little about what you're working on now and your future projects. In particular, I noticed you're doing work in bioethics and biopolitics.
Right. Yeah.
Could you say something about that and maybe about what you're working on next?
Yes, the work in bioethics and biopolitics is a Leverhulme project. The Leverhulme is a funding organization in England, and so we have this project that is running over 3 years to organize conferences, and we have two sort of research fellows associated with that. But my specific work, and it's the manuscript that I'm completing now, it's almost finished, has to do with the ethics, the anthropology, and also the political economy of desire. So I have tried to move quite systematically from a book of ontology that was called Truth and Genesis, to in which the relation between philosophy and science is addressed quite specifically, to the question of the relation between philosophy and art. And this is what we've been talking about today. And I have more recently moved into questions of philosophical anthropology, the relation between philosophy and ethics, and also politics and political economy, especially, and the notion, if you will, around which all of this revolves is the notion of desire. So desire for me is a little bit the equivalent of metaphor, but in connection with questions of ethics and politics. Now, of course, it would take us a little while to say why that is and why that notion of desire matters, but that probably would be for another discussion.
Well, I would certainly look forward to it. So, you know, I will keep that in mind for future reference.
Thank you.
Well, I guess we are at the end now, but I wish to thank you very much for a very illuminating interview and a wonderful book.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Miguel de Beistegui about his new book, Aesthetics After Metaphysics, From Mimesis to Metaphor, just out from Routledge as part of their Routledge series in contemporary philosophy. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.